Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, folks, I have to say earlier today when our producer, Paul Brennan, and our team, Maddie, and all of us were putting the show together, we realized that there really was, in a large way, a theme of geopolitical tensions. We talked a little bit about a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, what it would mean for just a possible scenario in terms of ships to the UK specifically. We had the president talk about objects in the sky, but getting ready to hopefully meet with President Xi. A lot going on. We've seen China and the US go back and forth with sanctions. So we wanted to check in and get a view on this. And we have a perfect guest to do that, and especially when it comes to concerns about, you know, possible escalating military tensions. So let's head to Colorado Springs, and that's where we find retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula. He's now advisory board member at Academy Securities, and he is with us via Zoom from Colorado Springs. General, thank you so much for being with us here at Bloomberg. There is a lot going on. U.S.-China, how do you kind of gauge the tensions that are out there and where it could possibly go?
Well, first, thanks very much for having me on. What I'd tell you is a very uncertain period of time right now. If you take a look at what's happened with respect to the Chinese spy craft that entered the United States and was eventually shot down, in the development of the U.S. government's understanding of the Chinese military goals and some of the new details that are coming out, they really reveal some misreadings of the U.S.'s reaction by Chinese officials. And that indicates just how difficult it is for the United States and China to discern each other's intentions. And quite frankly, the challenge there is that gap could lead to greater mistrust and or miscalculation. So we're still trying to figure out what's going on. You know, there are some people that believe that in all actuality, the balloon went off course. Mm-hmm. But then again, the Chinese officials and balloon operators appeared to make a series of bad decisions. So there's still a lot going on that the U.S. government still doesn't understand. And we've got to figure it out before we move. But the other thing this all points to is we've got to have better communication at the senior most levels between our two countries.
Well, and I will say, I thought the most notable thing of President Biden's comments earlier were that he does plan to reach out to President Xi. So it wasn't like that was a stop. What, in terms of that Chinese balloon, what is it that, as the president said, they're still kind of figuring stuff out and what it was all about? What development or what known information could come out that would make you a little concerned?
Well, I'll be frank with you, of more concern than whatever the balloon might have collected, it's the uncertainty, if you will, and the indecision that emanated from the Pentagon and the White House that was evidenced as the Chinese balloon entered the United States airspace. It was pretty clear that the administration didn't have an answer for that kind of a problem. And we still don't know if the Secretary of Defense actually notified the president when the spy craft originally entered Alaskan airspace or not until it entered the continental United States. Now, last week, to their credit, the Pentagon and the White House acted more rapidly, and clearly they were more prepared, and the president was notified in a timely manner. But the point that I would like to make with you or leave with you is the issue was not necessarily whatever intelligence could have been extracted by the balloon. It's the policy decision not to have shot it down once it was in U.S. airspace.
Well, and also potentially the lack of information about what's already in our airspace. When President Biden was speaking, he mentioned three action items, and the first one was just to establish a better inventory of what's going on in our own aerospace. Does that concern you at all, us kind of not having enough knowledge about our what's already up there?
And do you buy a recalibration of the radars?
An absolutely wonderful question. Let me offer, if I may, and I know time's of essence here, but sometimes these things are a bit complicated, but the North American Air Defense Command, or NORAD, was originally designed to detect and then defend North America from a catastrophic attack from the Soviet Union. And then back after 9/11, they had an additional role to intercept and identify and redirect any unknown aircraft or unidentified aircraft heading toward restricted airspace. So the NORAD radars are tuned to detect aircraft or missiles that meet that criteria. And balloons, at least until recently, generally don't fit that category. So in order to track both, will require modernization of NORAD's current radars, as well as additional radars, and quite frankly, a reversal in the decline of the resources that have been allocated to NORAD. Look, NORAD gets its aircraft from the Air Force, but our Air Force today is the oldest and the smallest it's ever been in its history. So just like the Air Force, NORAD's been underfunded and allowed to atrophy over the past 30 years. It's still employing Cold War era technology. Just to give you and your audience an example, in 1960, NORAD had about 2,000 aircraft under its command, and today they've got about 30 at any one time. So these intrusions ought to be a wake-up call to rebuild our air and space defenses.
So your perspective is that basically what this revealed is that our air and space defenses have some major holes, no pun intended, but that's the bottom line, at least from your perspective.
Absolutely.
So, okay. So having said that, that's one issue. And then, of course, there is, though, the way it kind of played out and just was a reminder of kind of the tensions that already existed between the United States and China. How do you see that relationship that has been a complicated one from the get-go? How do you see it where businesses still want that exposure? We know that, and yet we know it's a very tricky one.
Well, I think, you know, to the president's credit, he made the point that, look, we want to compete with China. We don't want to engage in a conflict with China. And I think what you'll see is a redoubling of efforts out of the State Department, the Department of Defense, and the White House to assure that there is greater connectivity at the senior most levels to be able to rapidly discuss and put some of these issues that may result in misinterpretation or miscommunication to bed. And so while there are lots of different avenues to explore with respect to what happened here, I think this has been a wake-up call for both the leadership of the United States as well as China, that we can't allow misunderstandings to get out of hand if, in fact,
we might be losing you a little bit, but
yeah, we've been listening.
Really interesting point that he's been making, Carol.
We've been talking to retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula. He is on the advisory board, and he is an advisory board member over at Academy Securities, and he's been talking with us from Colorado Springs. But it's interesting, obviously a military perspective, but talking about the potential, at least in his view, that there wasn't the correct spending or upgrading, if you will, in terms of the protections and the defense systems that are needed to protect our space, basically, and our aerospace.
Which is really interesting and in some ways alarming given some of the geopolitical tensions that we're facing globally right now. I was really curious to get his thoughts on a look ahead because we know that Blinken potentially meeting with Wang Yi in Munich later this week. I wonder what someone like him, Lieutenant General David Deptula, would be looking for out of that meeting. What would a clue be to indicate where U.S.-China relations are heading?
General Deptula, I know we've gotten our connection back. We've got about a minute or so left here. So There are said to be meetings with the Secretary of the United States, State Secretary, I should say, Antony Blinken, coming up between he and Chinese officials. What is it that you kind of keep on your radar when it comes to those kinds of meetings?
Well, I apologize that the connection dropped off there, but what I was about to say or was in the midst of saying is that if anything good comes out of this particular incident, it's the fact that at senior levels, at the Secretary of State level, Secretary of Defense level, in discussions with their counterparts in China, they've got to develop more rapid means of being able to communicate to dampen down and explain different perspectives when these kinds of situations arise. Furthermore, I think the president was spot on when he articulated the message to the Chinese that they're going to need to stop these kinds of intrusions with respect to blatant disregard for U.S. airspace, whether it be over Alaska, the continental United States, Guam, or Hawaii. So those are a couple of issues that I think could move us toward an era where there's greater communication and understanding, not less.
All right, we're going to leave it on that, and hopefully we can catch up with you real soon. David Deptula, he is, of course, U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General, retired. He's an advisory board member over at Academy Securities. I am tongue-twisted on this Thursday, joining us via Zoom from Colorado Springs. But I do feel like anything U.S.-China, really pivotal and obviously one of our main geopolitical issues going forward.
Absolutely. It's critical to watch.
All right, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg Radio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, folks, another day, another concern when it comes to a shooting here in the United States. This time yesterday at a mall in El Paso that killed one person, injured three others. It comes on the heels of the Monday night shooting at Michigan State University that killed three students and critically wounded five others. There are truly no words at this point about this national crisis in the U.S. So let's get to it with someone who has been studying this. Joshua Horwitz is co-director of the Center for Gun Violence Solutions at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, as you know, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Mike, also co-founder and supporter of Every Town for Gun Safety. Josh, on the phone from Baltimore. Josh, good to have you here. I wish we kind of didn't have to have you here because it means we've had more shootings. They have become so much the norm. How do you look at it, and how do we change the narrative? How do we change the reality?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I'm very appreciative of that. And, you know, in the wake of these two terrible tragedies, I say this almost every time on the radio, but I'm just so sorry to the families and the survivors who have had to go through yet another terrible incident. So, you know, I think there's a couple of things for the listeners to keep in mind. Number one, this is not inevitable. This has not always been what this country is about. But in the last several years, we've seen an incredible increase in people killed by guns, which includes homicide and suicides and police violence as well. But that's only almost 49,000 people were killed in 2021. That's up 8% from 2020. And gun homicides in general have increased about 45% between 2019 and 2021. And it seems like we have a mass shooting. If it seems like we have a mass shooting every day in America, it's because we actually have two. Already in this year, there's been 72 mass shootings, and there's lots we can do about it. So I'm happy to jump in if that's what you want me to keep going on right now.
Yeah, I mean, solutions. Yeah, help us have some hope here.
So I think number one, you know, we've seen a proliferation of assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And that's, you know, these shooters often use this, not in the MSU shooting, but just think about all the other shootings, you know, from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas into some of the shootings, the last shooting in El Paso, right, and the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, all these things that are fueled by hate. Assault weapons are often the weapons of choice, and certainly guns with high-capacity magazines. And those used to be banned, between 1995 and 2005, and that made a difference. And from a policy perspective, but a moral perspective as well, we should not have weapons of war running around our streets for anybody over 18 who sometimes, even without a background check, can purchase these weapons. So that's something that we really need to focus on. And there's some good policy levers that we have as well. We have laws that we know work, like licensing the purchase of firearms. We've seen dramatic results in states that have enacted purchasing laws, and then worse results. For instance, Missouri got rid of their permit law. We saw a dramatic increase in homicides and suicides. So we know that there are laws out there that work. Other things that we want to see are better domestic firearm removal laws. We know that domestic violence is often a threat in some of these mass shootings, so there's a link between domestic violence and mass shootings, and we know we need to do a better job removing firearms from people who are under protective order or have a domestic violence conviction.
Josh, can I just jump in for a second? I don't know if you saw yesterday, West Virginia lawmakers voting to advance a bill that would allow people with concealed carry permits to bring firearms onto state, college, and university campuses. That's despite overwhelming opposition from frustrated students who came to the Capitol there to testify against it. I mean, I feel like the trend is going in the other direction, unfortunately.
So it depends what state you're in. There are certainly states like West Virginia, and you can think about, you know, southern states like Alabama and Missouri, Mississippi and Missouri, where the trend is going the wrong way. There are other states that have made a big passed a lot of great laws and saved a lot of lives. You can think of places like Massachusetts and Connecticut and New York and, you know, California, where there were a number of horrible shootings a couple weeks ago. But if you look at their average numbers over the years, they've enacted a strong suite of gun violence prevention laws, and on average, their gun violence has gone down dramatically and is well below the national average. So we don't have to accept this. And our research at the center is very clear: the more guns, more concealed carry weapons, the more violent crime. That's just a given. And so the idea that we're now going to introduce that into a college environment, you know, with people who are you know, using alcohol, which is a risk factor, and people who are just starting their adult lives and might not have enough emotional regulation, this is a horrible idea, and it goes against all of the evidence that we have.
Well, I also can't stop thinking about this CDC report from earlier this week. We haven't had a chance to talk about it yet, Carol, but it really showed this increase in mental health concerns among teenagers, showing nearly 30% of teen girls have reported considering suicide. I wonder, Josh, if you can talk about to what extent is the guns issue in our country impacting mental health for kids?
And just got about 30 seconds.
So, look, when you have a mental health problem and then you have easy access to firearms, that's when these things become lethal. And it's not surprising that we are seeing a rise, especially in the Black community, of we've seen an unprecedented rise of firearm suicide among Black youth. And that's actually, I think there's more access to firearms now, and we have to really focus on this across the board. But we're seeing some unprecedented rises among young people and firearms violence, and that's something we need to be really addressing.
Well, so glad we did get some time for you. Like I said, we love talking with you, but we wish the trend was going in a different direction. Josh Horowitz over at Johns Hopkins, Bloomberg School of Public Health, co-director of the Center for Gun Violence Solutions.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
amid all the talk about rolling recessions, soft landings, and the new one, no landings, this week, our Business Week team took the time to note the upcoming one-year mark 1 week from tomorrow since that Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Kind of hard to believe it's still going on. Well, several stories in this special double issue on the destruction in Eastern Europe, including the cover story and how it's becoming clear that the cost to both sides will turn out to be intolerably high. For more, we turn to Bloomberg News automation editor and opinion columnist Leonid Bershitsky, along with the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, Joel Weber.
In absolute numbers, Russia has actually lost more than Ukraine because the Russian economy was so much bigger to start with before the war. So even though Russia is not economically devastated, it's not about to go bankrupt, it's not depending on external aid the way Ukraine is, but it's lost an enormous amount of money. It's lost more than $100 billion in GDP terms. And that is before we start factoring in the loss of life, the immigration, all of these factors that are also war-related.
Leonid, and of course the war continues, you talk about loss, and you're right, you talk about the impact on economic activity, you name it, but the loss of life in terms of people who have actually, you know, died as a result of this war, but also people who are leaving the countries, whether it's Russia or Ukraine, you do think about the lasting impact of that, that when we get, fingers crossed, on the other side of this, what it ultimately means.
Yeah, well, here in Berlin, where I live, also as a Russian emigre, by the way, who left Russia when the war actually began in 2014, we see a huge influx of people from both Ukraine and Russia. And a year after the war began, some of these families have settled in, and you know, the kids are in school, people have found jobs, they've learned the beginnings of the language, and a lot of these people, a lot of the Ukrainian refugees too, are not going to go back. The German Migration Office recently held a poll that showed about 30% of the Ukrainian refugees are not planning on going back to Ukraine after the war is over. The actual percentage is probably higher. So even apart from the actual killing and the actual war damage, the actual casualties, the loss of the brain drain, the loss of talent, the loss of active people, and it is active people who leave under such circumstances. In Ukraine, it's overwhelmingly women, and they've taken their kids with them. So there's going to be extended fallout, even once the battlefield action is over. The human losses for both economies will be substantial.
Imagine a world where the battlefield, we finally might have a version of a truce or something. What would it look like on both sides when this conflict eventually does end? Because even any outcome, these sanctions have been so successful, but you know, it does not seem like easing these sanctions eventually will end in any sort of resolution where this is instant. The recovery is instantaneous, right? We're looking at years here.
Yeah, we're definitely looking at the worst part of this is that it's almost impossible to imagine an ending to the military action at this point, because there's really no common ground. There's no way the sides can agree on anything until one of them is satisfied that it's won. And, victory for both sides seems pretty remote at this point. But even just imagining something has happened and the war has ended, The sanctions against Russia will not be lifted again, even if Russia loses. They can only be lifted if the Putin regime falls and the successors are more pro-Western and willing to, you know, to take pretty unimaginable steps in terms of rejoining the Western world. So the sanctions are going to be around for many years. The devastation in Ukraine requires hundreds of billions of dollars of investment to rebuild what was destroyed. It's not clear where that kind of money would come from. From Russian reparations, it's not clear how much in terms of reparations Russia would actually be able to pay, whether it's possible to confiscate any of the frozen Russian international reserves to fund the rebuilding of Ukraine. It's not clear how interested Western governments will be in providing more money once the war is over,
right,
especially the enormous amounts that are required, because entire cities have been wiped off the face of the earth.
All right, that, of course, is Bloomberg News automation editor and opinion columnist Leonid Bershitsky, along with our Bloomberg Businessweek editor, Joel Weber, who joins us in studio right now. I'm so glad we were able to catch up with him.
Yeah, and obviously there's going to be a lot more written about the one-year mark between from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We felt like we, you know, absolutely needed to talk about this because of the devastating economic implications on both sides of the border. And, you know, another one that really caught my eye was from our colleague Natalia Drozdiak. And when she happened to be in New York and, like, kind of whispered this one to me, and I was like, wait, what? Which is there's a shortage of ammo around the world. And that is one of those fascinating stories that I asked her to kind of like turn her reporting to, and there's more to do there too.
I gotta say, there's a great photo essay, and there's one photo in particular of two young girls. I'm not gonna tell you more about it. You've gotta go to the website or check out the magazine. Joel Weber, thank you so much. This is the cover story of the special double issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. It is out now. This is Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive. Keep driving,
keep crazy. It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got just about 12 minutes left, a little bit under, more like 11 minutes left in today's session. A lot going on. Watching the trade here, just a quick update for you, because stocks pretty much at their lows of the session. What does that mean? The S&P is down 1.2%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, we're looking at a decline of 1%. NASDAQ taking the biggest hit on a percentage basis, down about 1.5%. Quick check on the Treasury trade, because we've seen yields certainly popping up on some of that hot economic news. 10-year note with a yield of 3.86%. And it is just off its highs of the day's two-year note, most sensitive to Fed policy, with a yield of 4.64 off its highs of the days. So let's get to it. Our market guest, Ken Van Leeuwen, CEO and founder of the wealth management firm Van Leeuwen & Company, joining us via Zoom from Princeton, New Jersey. Ken, good to have you back with us. How are you?
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Well, a lot going on this week. Maddie and I try to keep on top of it. A lot of economic news and a lot of Fed speak. Give us your macro take on this environment and what it means for investment plays right now.
Well, it's really interesting, Carol, because what we're seeing, of course, is that, of course, today's comment about PPI indicates, we think, that the economy is stronger than what was anticipated. You know, we've gotten some pretty strong economic numbers the last 2 weeks, especially Tuesday's number and employment number. So we think the Fed, and that's what's kind of pushing the market down today, right? Bullard came out and said that basically he thinks in March that we're going to have to raise again by another half a point rather than these quarter point hikes that we just went through. So again, the Fed has its mandate to control inflation, and it looks like they're going to be doing that. So that's what's pushing rates up, of course, and the market's down today.
Ken, I want to ask you a totally wild and random question here. I know that you just wrote a little piece about how meeting with prospective clients can be like a blind date. Can you give me some of your advice? What would you tell clients to ask you if they were on a blind date with you?
Well, first of all, I'd want them to ask me about my experience, right? Like, what have you done? How long have you been doing this? Of course, I have some gray hair, so they can tell I've been doing this for a while. So I'd ask them about that. I'd ask me, have they ever, you know, I'd want to them to explain their situation a little bit and say, have you ever worked with individuals like myself?
Yeah.
And can you give me some solutions to solve that? And then I'd want to say, you know, how are you qualified? I mean, what kind of designations do you have? What makes you so special? Why are you good at what you do? You know, I would also want to ask, how do I get paid? I mean, which is the ultimate question. Sure. So, yeah, but it's a great thing going on these dates, actually. It's one of the best parts of my business that I really enjoy.
Well, it's important, especially because retail investors, obviously, we know by now they're here to stay. What is your single biggest piece of advice for retail investors today, given the macroeconomic headwinds we're facing? What would you tell a retail investor to watch out for?
Well, a couple things. To watch out for is that I worry about, you know, chasing a trend. Okay. Like, I think one of the things is that, of course, earlier in the week, we all about AI, everybody was piling into Microsoft and shunning Google. While I think that Microsoft is a great company, did it deserve the price increases that it got earlier in the week? I'm not sure of that, right?
Why is that? Can I stick with you on that for a second? Why is that with Microsoft?
Well, what's happening there a little bit, I think what you're just saying is that's because that's the next revolution. And I think investors still want the next best thing. They're still chasing that illusion. Well, it's not an illusion, but they're still chasing, you know, a big winner. Because, you know, we had big winners in 2021 and 2020. Last year, not so much. But people still want that big growth stock that's going to go up 5-10 times.
So is Microsoft something you would commit some new money to because of the AI play and the ChatGPT play?
We own it currently, so we would continue to hold it, but we wouldn't chase it right now because I think there was a news report actually today that it was creating some kind of unseemly conversations when people would put requests into Bing. So, you know, that's kind of, it still has to be perfected. I think it's a long way from being there.
All right, Intel, let's stay with the tech space for you, Will. We know we've got AMAT reporting in the semi space after the closing bell. What is it about Intel specifically, which feels like it's been struggling for some time to kind of make some headway and kind of get itself on a new trajectory?
See, one of the things that I think an overall theme of what we like is strong dividend payers. Intel with a dividend yield over 5%, and, you know, clearly they've struggled lately. They've lost, actually, ground positioning to AMD.
Right.
But they're still a tremendous brand. And, you know, long term, in our belief, is that brands win out. That's why we like that Intel. You know, they've got a lot of work to do. They're building these new factories in Ohio, but that's the dividend is really what is appealing. to us.
Let me follow on that, Ken, because our story on the Bloomberg by our Ian King and Ryan Vlastelica talks about how Intel is among those that the street seems to be saying is prime for a dividend cut, because I think at the current rate, Morgan has put out there and some other analysts, at the current rate, Intel's dividend projected to cost more than $6 billion this year, and that, you know, the company's got to focus on heavy spending, needed to regain its manufacturing leadership, and that as a result, they'll have to cut shareholder payouts. So does that still make it interesting for you?
It still makes it interesting because what we've seen in the past, right? Because I think it's the overall health of the company for Intel. Mm-hmm. Yes, the dividend right now at this rate could potentially be cut, but I'd still a buyer here at its low valuation. Remember, it's only selling at 10 times, which is a historically low valuation for Intel, to be sure.
And that's kind of your view on selective tech names. I want to go over to the consumer discretionary side because that's the fun side from my perspective.
Yes, that's a great side.
Talk to me about, let's go to Ulta Beauty because they've got a big competitor with Sephora and obviously a lot of other big players in the beauty space. Why do you like Ulta?
Well, first of all, you know, we like Ulta because it's a tremendously well-managed store chain. They've got many great things. Now I think they're introducing where you can even get your hair done, your nails done, things of that nature there in the different stores. Also, I think their long-term goals of expanding in China is something that's very, very, very appealing to us. And frankly, the CEO we think is one of the best retailing CEOs in the country right now.
Can I ask why?
Why? Just look at the growth that she has delivered to her shareholders. So I think that in a tough environment, right, when we saw basically she came through COVID, she performed well last year and is continuing to show us this year what they can do.
Just got about 30 seconds left here. In terms of the semi space, you do, since AMAT's reporting, just quickly 30 seconds, on semi you like, why that name?
On because that's the semis in terms of the digital experience and the ability to it's the semiconductor chip that basically can follow you around basically, and with all that, you know, basically in cameras and all those different things right now, that semiconductor space is one of the few areas that's growing right now. And On is one of the leaders, and they're a U.S.-based company. So, and they manufacture here in the U.S. So that's why we like that one.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.